The exquisite voice of Dawn Upshaw here, giving voice to nature in its mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, expressing loss and tender beauty. Composer Earl Kim set this poem, Ophelia, by Arthur Rimbaud, as part of his song cycle, Where Grief Slumbers. In an interview with broadcaster Bruce Duffy in 1995, Kim explained, "I happen to like the human voice because, for me, it is perhaps the most expressive, direct means of communication. There's no intervention of other things, although it can be combined, of course, with other instruments. That's one thing. The other thing is that I'm very fond of texts, of words, of poetry as a secondary passion of mine. So it's quite natural that I'd want to combine the two." Duffy and Kim also spoke about Kim and his teaching. Kim said, "I certainly attempt to encourage my students to write what they really believe in and to hang on to that because they have to find their own voice. For young people, that's difficult. Obviously, we don't teach composition. You can guide them. You can make some criticism. You can encourage them, or you can discourage them. But that has always been very much a part of my attitude toward composition students, to try to understand just what it is that they're aiming for, regardless of the style or the technique. Whether it's whole note or serialed, I don't think that's of any consequence. Although it may even be arrogant to say so, my responsibility is to attempt to find just what it is that the student is about and try to encourage whatever that is, if it is truly what they are about. That's what teaching is about." WVIA listeners have come to know Earl Kim as a composer and a teacher over the years through Kim's student and friend and advocate, Paul Salerni, who is an award-winning composer in his own right. Dr. Salerni was the NEH Distinguished Chair in the Humanities and Professor of Music at Lehigh University in Bethlehem before announcing his retirement after 45 years. And he has been a long-time friend of WVIA as well. Dr. Salerni has told us of the enormous gift his teacher, Earl Kim, gave to him.
This is the real irony of the story, because singing was, I was in the church choir for a very short amount of time, even though I was already musical because I was playing the accordion. I never sang in the choirs in high school. I joined the Amherst Glee Club and I was kicked out in my junior year because I was so terrible. And I didn't like the choir director very much. And so choirs were never things I was comfortable with. And I didn't like song literature for as long as I can remember. And I didn't like the opera until I went to graduate school and my beloved mentor, Earl Kim, said, "You have to learn the entirety of the Marriage of Figaro." And that's when all of a sudden singing became wonderful to me.
And your life was transformed by that experience.
Absolutely transformed. Absolutely. I always loved Mozart, but I didn't know how much I loved Mozart and the beauties of what one could do with the voice and one could express. And then, I met my wife, who loved Italian opera and art song, and then spending time with Earl. So in the time I spent with Earl, often after dinner, we would go play forehand music, but we'd also read through Schubert and Schumann art songs. So that's where I acquired this love.
Paul Salerni, speaking of the love of Mozart and art song and writing for the human voice that was a gift from his revered teacher, mentor, and friend, Earl Kim. And ultimately, it was a love for Earl Kim himself. Paul has been a tireless advocate for the music of Earl Kim while Kim was still alive and since his passing in 1998. Laura Johnson, highly respected director of opera and theater, has joined with her husband, Paul, in staging works by Earl Kim and conducting significant research about Kim's life and work. Paul and Laura have been integral players in a recent documentary film titled simply Earl. It's Earl with a period. Tai Kim is an Emmy Award-winning director, producer, and writer from Los Angeles, who worked for years with Mike Wallace and Ed Bradley at the TV news magazine CBS News 60 Minutes. We're about to learn the way he came to tell the story of composer Earl Kim and how it was the discovery, literally, of Earl's voice that unlocked the key to the entire documentary. Following the premiere of the film in March at Harvard University, where Earl had taught for over two decades and where Paul Salerni studied with Earl, Paul, Laura Johnson, and Tai Kim drove from Cambridge, Massachusetts to Bethlehem with a pit stop at the WVIA Benko studio to talk with us about the documentary and how it took shape. One of the most important aspects of the piece are the dozens of interviews that help us get to know Earl Kim. And now we have a chance to hear Tai Kim's personal story in that regard, and we bring it to you on August 11th, 2025. August 9th, 2025 marked the 80th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Nagasaki, and August 10th, yesterday, marked the 80th anniversary of the flight Earl Kim took as a U.S. Army intelligence officer over the site of that destruction and devastation, with the ever-haunting memory of those ruins and of a lone truck aimlessly making its way through the rubble. Tai Kim tells that saga and more carefully and powerfully, but we begin with music in Tai's life that may have prepared him to meet Earl Kim and share something very deep about his voice in all senses of the word with us, about Earl's voice with all of us.
I did not have the kind of teachers like Paul Salerni or Earl Kim up my sleeve or Laura Johnson. I literally started in a public school setting on instrument day, picking a cello up and thinking, sure, why not? And my mother found a wonderful cellist who was teaching. She lived in the Hastings on the Hudson, Francesca Church, and she was a student of Pablo Casals. And so my mother took me there, and Mrs. Church was very patient. But I did get through public school on the cello and made it to Stanford and was a music scholarship student there, and really had my first great teacher. Teachers make such a big difference. We've talked so much in the car driving here, Paul, Laura, and I, about having the impact of a great teacher in your life, somebody who inspires you. And I had a gentleman named Andor Toth, who was a principal player in George Zell's Cleveland Orchestra, and he took the job of head of the music department at Stanford when I was there. So he coached our piano trio. And I will tell you that having Andor Toth as a teacher and then Gabby Rido, who played with Heifetz and Piatigorsky in that inner ring of amazing collaborative recordings that are still to this day some of the great wonderful chamber recordings with Mr. Heifetz at the center of the storm, was an experience. And that was one of the great learning experiences, as I've explained to my children, who accelerated through classical music. And when they surpassed me at a very young age, it was exciting to see the power of music to change lives. And that, to me, is the message of this documentary, Earl Kim, about Earl Kim, because it absolutely can transform a person's trajectory if you have great teachers, if you have great parents, if you have the ability to study, in Earl's case, with Schoenberg, Arnold Schoenberg, Roger Sessions, Ernest Bloch, even with his career interrupted by World War II, I marvel at the idea that there was this embrace that occurred in his mind, even between classical music and composing in his case, and finding his voice, his authentic voice.
And we have heard from Paul Salerni that as a teacher, Earl was all about inviting the student, listening to the students, not just the music that the student would produce, but the student's, deep heart, deep soul, and wanting the student to find his or her voice.
I think that's a remarkable statement, truly from a documentarian's point of view, is that when you meet somebody who says, be yourself, try to find your authentic voice, and then to see his students in some ways far exceed their public recognition and acclaim than their teacher, I will say to you that that is a rare individual who is extremely secure in their ability to know their craft and their mission in life. And that is something that people who have talked about the film and have enjoyed the film and what resonates about the film. I've said to my colleagues and my classmates, you know, I went to Harvard Business School, and I'm getting these emails now in the middle of the night from different places around the country and in some cases abroad, and they want to know more about the film. What's it about? And I tell them, it's not a film about classical music. It's not even a film about music or a musician or a composer. If you really look at this person's life, the depth and the trajectory of their life, some people connect with the fact that Earl, on a very human level, had his obstacles. He was born into a working class, very poor family, as he describes it. Many of us know what it's like, maybe not to, his parents worked the fields of Danuba, California. He had two older brothers. They struggled. His parents literally worked in the fields picking vegetables and picking fruit. And I went to Danuba. I took a crew to Danuba and I said, let's go see what it's like. It was 114 degrees. And I said, no complaining. The crew was absolutely shocked because we got out of the car and a plume of dust emanated from the ground all the way up to our chin. And I said, I'll shoot it myself. I held the camera above my eye line so the dust wouldn't go into the aperture and into the glass of the lens. And I started to walk into this field where there were crops growing. And as I walked, the dust covered me. I was like Pigpen and Peanuts, right? And then something magical occurred. A white stork-like bird appeared out of nowhere and walked out of the crops. And it looked at me, I looked at it, and then I think when it saw I was no threat, it started wandering and I followed it. It let me follow it. And this bird, I wish I knew the species, because I know your listeners are very smart. And so you're going to have people who know their birds and they're going to go, it wasn't a stork. What are you talking about? But it was a beautiful white, tall bird. And that resembled so strikingly an embroidery painting that Earl's mother had created. She was an expert seamstress. And at that moment, just as in a few moments along the way making these films, you feel like you're in the right place. You feel like you know you're where you should be. And it was a magical moment. And I included it in the film. And you can see it take flight, its majestic wings spreading out and flying away. And we sort of felt at that moment that the trip to Danuba to discover what it was like to be in his shoes, to feel the heat and feel what it was like. I remember there was also this mural in downtown Danuba. I don't know if they've cleaned it up by now, but they had this beautiful mural painted of all these moments. And there was a banner, "Where Dreams Go." And somebody wrote, lies in a Sharpie on it, as if they were bitter or angry about their position in life. And I will say that, you know, when we were there, I wanted to go inside a cannery factory, and they had closed it because of the pandemic. It was those moments where you sort of see what it's like to be in a place when it meant something to be there, when Earl and his family were there. And so we're very, very lucky that this journey has meant that we traveled to three continents, filmed over 33 interviews, many of them twice, three times, to do what you do, which is to verify our facts, get our story, you know, completely accurate. And my journeys have led me to really be able to be friends with Earl's family, Earl's extended family, Earl's students. I mean, Paul Salerni and Laura Johnson have embraced me and have been so patient with helping. And every single person we've interviewed has given us that invitation to learn about this extraordinary individual.
Picking up on that, Ty, how did you get to know Earl as you were going along? Was it partly through the music? Was it through these interviews?
It's a great question, Erica. The real story, which I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble or not telling you this, but I'll tell you exactly how it happened. I made a film about an incredible cellist named Lynn Harrell, and that film was seen by many influential people in the classical music world. The cast, it's a dream team cast. I mean, John Williams, Yo-Yo Ma, Itzhak Perlman, the last interview Andre Previn ever gave, Anna Sophie Mutter. The list is so long and beautiful. Like, I met my heroes in that film. And one day I got a call from someone that I've known for quite some time, but not in the context of having worked with them. And it's a chamber orchestra called the Sejong Soloists, which is based in New York City and in Seoul, Korea. They're one of the top chamber orchestras, certainly in the world. And they have people like the concertmaster of the New York Philharmonic playing in that group, or routinely these musicians who have trained and gone through that program are some of the best in the world at what they do. And so she called me, the head of the Sejong Soloists, their executive director, Kyung Kang is her name, and her husband, Hyo Kang, who teaches at Juilliard and at Yale, brilliant, brilliant destination teacher in the violin. And she said, this is exactly how she put it, in fact, would you be interested in doing a documentary about someone who's no longer alive, whose music you've never heard, and who never gave an interview ever before? And I said, that is the worst pitch I have ever heard in my life. And I said, no, I'm not interested. I'm pretty busy. So that was the end of that, I thought. And then I got another call a few weeks later, and she said, well, we're looking at this other director, which I think was meant to trigger my interest again. She said, and she's doing this big documentary on the boy band BTS. And I cut her off and I said, definitely hire her. You should hire her. That's awesome. Go for it. And that was sort of confusing to her, I think, and end of conversation. And then I got this call again, and this is where my wife Felicia said, don't tell the story completely. But I got another call from her, and she said, I have a question to ask you. And I was, sure, what is your question? And she said, well, I'm interviewing that director I told you about. And she said that she carries around with her a book by Samuel Beckett in her purse. And what do you think of that? And I basically said, I think that's bull beep, right? I said, I don't believe it. And I said, I've met a couple thousand people and interviewed quite a few in my life as a journalist at 60 Minutes and at NBC, and not one of them have been carrying around a book by Samuel Beckett. And, you know, look, she's telling you what you want to hear so that she gets the job. I respect that. And there was silence on the other end of the phone, and she laughed. There was this huge laughter, and that sort of broke the ice. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take a look at this man just after these, you know, we call it in basketball, hardcore press approaches. And so there wasn't a lot about Earl Kim on the internet. I Googled him naturally. That's where everyone starts. You Google somebody. And I think I found an LA Phil program that mentioned that Earl had flown over Nagasaki one day after the atomic bomb had been dropped. And I said, who is this guy? I have to know more about him. And it's the individual that fascinated me, because one of my, you know, we talk about Earl as a part of a story of something that is part of the fabric of my career now. But in 1989, I negotiated the entry of CBS News into North Korea. And I went to Pyongyang with the CBS Evening News and the foreign editor at the time, Robert Anderson, who's a good friend. We just had dinner just about a week ago, and we were talking about North Korea and how it all started. And then Bob and I went to go work for Mike Wallace. But I had that feeling, you know, you get in the pit of your stomach, like maybe I've done something that I shouldn't be doing. Because I remember being there, it was very scary, very difficult as an assignment journalistically, and being of Korean ancestry, I'm Korean American, I was born and raised in the US. It's unheard of to go back to a place like, or go to a place like North Korea and have them in any way think that you're not an agent for this place or that place. And so when I heard about Nagasaki, it stopped me in my tracks, and I started to think more about this individual. Who is this person? And immediately I knew that I knew nothing about his music. I mean, Kyung and Hyo gave me a few recordings, and I looked up a few others, and I just did not understand it at all. It was a little confusing. It was a little bit, I mean, it brought out the ignorance in me, just didn't know how to process it. And Paul Salerni took such great care. He reminded me of my professors at Harvard Business School, who said, you know, look, these complex ideas of finance, theoretically, will not make sense for 6 months. Put it on your calendar. In 6 months from now, the standard deviation of the mean will make sense to you. You'll understand what it means. And sure enough, Paul was very patient, and he said, you know, I want you to think of it this way. And Laura Johnson said, I think you should really take a look at this part of his work, and this is how he was regarded, and his collaboration with Samuel Beckett. And again, one of the things that I do, I think, rather effectively, is I'm willing to declare my ignorance. I never try to pretend I know something that I don't, which is why talking to somebody like John Harbison, who won the Pulitzer Prize for music, a student of Earl Kim's, I remember asking him when he mentioned the name Arnold Schoenberg, because I wanted to hear his answer. I said, who is Arnold Schoenberg? And he looked at me like, you're an idiot, or that you're so earnest in the way you're asking the question, I'm going to answer it. So he answers it, and I had an idea of who Arnold Schoenberg was, but he gave me a very different kind of response in a kind way. And that's been my experience meeting Paul Salerni, Anthony Brandt, John Harbison, Kurt Stallman, you know, some of the great students of Earl Kim, and people, Scott Yu. Oh, I had a great interaction with Scott. It sounds silly, but I'm so proud of him, like what he's accomplished. He's an amazing artist. And the film was presented at Festival Mosaic. I'm very, very grateful to Scott getting early traction with Festival Mosaic. The film has won, well, it's been selected by 7 festivals so far. It's won a bunch of awards. So what that really means is that it's been seen by people that they're objective, and they're not only classical music fans, right? But I really felt like going through this group of people that are so intelligent, so accomplished, so patient, that each one of them have been so gentle and so giving, and so generous of their time, and they've all been just super friendly.
There are so many things to ask you about in terms of the choices that you made to give us this experience of Earl and his circle. But let's turn now to his voice. We've had wonderful conversations with Paul Salerni about Earl Kim encountering Samuel Beckett and Beckett's work and how that was somehow a way for Earl to find his musical compositional voice.
Absolutely. I think that there's a lot to unpack there because it's a great question. I think the film really found its, we talk about in business language, inflection points, right? You could go left, you could go right, it could fall apart. We talk about reaching sort of this point of where it actually gives its own meaning of how it starts. And I had heard from Martha Potter Kim, the widow of Earl Kim. She said, you know, Ty, this was one of those late night phone calls in the middle of the night where she's, how's it going? And I'm like, tell me really what's going on. Well, she said, you know, Ty, I was thinking about this. I remember at one point somebody visiting the house at 57 Francis Street with a tape recorder. So I think somebody might have interviewed him. And I went, wow, what a gem. Do you remember anything more about it? No, didn't remember anything else. So I started on this pathway to try to find out and I found who had visited, and it was a gentleman who lives in Australia now. And I tried to contact him, and because Erica, we know what it's like, the value of finding that kind of sound is like finding treasure, like gold in your hand, right? And I got a rough copy of part of the interview, and I thought to myself, well, if I could get a clean copy and get permission. So I was able to discover who did the interview. I was able to discover that it was in a private archive that had never been accessed before. And then that opened up this spinal cord for the story that I knew I had something special. And then there was another interview by Bruce Duffy in Chicago, who was a really legendary classical music journalist. And he had interviewed Earl in 1980 in Chicago. And I tried so hard to reach him. And Martha said, you know, I tried to reach him over the years. He doesn't often respond. On the website, it says there's a copy of the film at Northwestern, copy of the audio tape at Northwestern. And I really tried hard doing all of the things that I learned working as a journalist at 60 Minutes. And I broke through. I got him to respond by email. And I explained who I was. And I had Martha verify that I was who I was. And he said, I will lend you a copy of this tape with the expressed understanding that I'm never going to do it again. You're the only person I'll ever let you have a copy of this. Do not do anything except do what you do with it. So two things happened. One is that I took the interviews that I found, and I found other snippets of things. Eva Kim, Earl's daughter, found a little snippet of something. And I went about piecing this puzzle together chronologically of Earl explaining his story in his own words. And that is the jackpot. When you're working in radio, when you're working in audio, you dream about this. And I felt not only had I discovered the soul of Earl Kim, but I knew then that the 33 interviews that we filmed would have to revolve around Earl's thoughts and Earl's words. And my wife, we turned our house in Santa Monica into sort of like your radio operation here. All of the personal things that mattered, like a dining table where you eat food, that turned into like an edit station for my people to come and visit. And all of these artifacts and research papers that Laura was saying, you should read this, you should read that, take a look at this. And so piles and boxes, and the house got overtaken by Earl Kim. And so in the middle of the night, my wife would wander out, kind of concerned, hearing Earl's voice wafting over the speakers, like thinking, this is insanity. This is, how are you going to put this thing together? And she deserves so much credit, so much patience. Paul and Laura have spent time with her now at the Harvard screening and have met my mother and father as well, who are, they were all very encouraging. This was absolutely a dragon in terms of trying to not tame it, but find a way to cooperate with the direction it was flying and being respectful of the fact that the story would lead in certain ways to certain places. But the wings were made of Itzhak Perlman leaving a rehearsal at the Hollywood Bowl. Sure, I'll spend a couple hours with you and talk with you about my friend Earl Kim, or going down to Rice University and having three professors drop their schedules to, okay, we'll talk with you about Earl. Anything you need, we'll do. I mean, I don't know how many times I call Laura, probably, I think too many to count, saying, what year was that? Do you remember the year of that? Because a lot of this was not fully documented. I mean, Samuel Beckett, that visit, I broke through to a lovely relative, Earl's stepdaughter, Emily Odza, who I just spoke to a few days ago. She said to me, look, I'm not fully on board with this, because she said, I want you to make me a promise that my mother, Mimi Kagan, and her contributions to Earl's life and his magnum opus, Exercises en Route, I want you to really look at that objectively, and I want you to include the fact that she not only introduced Earl to Samuel Beckett, and Laura's nodding because Laura was like, this is absolutely a significant part of the story. And when we go from there, conceptually, and Emily giving me that interview was so important to thread the family's history into, sensitively, into this artist. It's really a portrait of an artist as a young man, a middle-aged man, and a man who died before his time. And to understand the artist, you have to understand that there was this person who was living his life around his art. And one of the journeys that took place, I really haven't talked about this that much or at all, is I flew to Paris. My daughter was having her internship in Berlin. And I always back into it by saying to my wife, Felicia, and my daughter, Sabrina, we're going to be in the area anyway. And how about we take this detour to Paris? My daughters, I'm in Berlin, Dad. You want to go to Paris. So you should go to Paris and Mom will help me launch my internship. So we launched her, and then Felicia and I went to Paris for 4.5 days. We visited 15 locations, retraced the steps of Earl Kim with the help of Carolyn Kim, his niece. She has a son who lives in Paris, Greg, and they were so supportive. But I will tell you that I talked my way into the buildings where Beckett lived. The first place where he lived in Paris, not a great neighborhood, not trying to trash it, but not a great neighborhood. Talked my way in, spoke to the residents and the landlord. We tried to locate the exact apartment where he wrote Waiting for Godot. It was magical in that way. Visited his second residence where Earl Kim and Samuel Beckett met. Talked my way into there because there was a family cleaning their windows on the first floor. Sure, come on in, you know, and what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm working on this project. And they're like, oh, how interesting. They showed me a mailbox with Beckett's name on it that still exists to this day. And then went to all these other locations, that the three cafes that Beckett hung out, the alley where Beckett was stabbed by a pimp, the prison where the pimp was held. I tried to talk my way into there, and a gendarme with broken English said to me, dangerous, do not stop. Because I mean, I've been to my share of prisons around the world, third world prisons and all that. And I just wanted to see for myself what was inside. So the burning curiosity that led Earl Kim onto that boxcar plane to assemble a crew to fly over Nagasaki, it reminded me that if we follow our curiosity, if we're pure of heart, if we're lucky, if we have that real sort of pure desire to learn and to grow, then good things can happen. And that's sort of the story of the film. Good things happened, you know, because of Paul and Laura and Martha and Eva, and the list is really quite something. It's been a journey.
Without affecting the balance of the film, we do get a continuing sense as the film goes on of his burning moral conscience.
Yes.
And the way you presented the Nagasaki episode, again, you could have sensationalized it, but you were able to handle it in a way that we could understand that this was an event that, like radiation, would continue to decay and affect his life from that moment on.
It's a very, very important part of the journey. There are three ticks in the timeline. August 9th, 1945 was the atomic bombing of the Japanese city of Nagasaki. That is pure, in a way, destiny, which is a hard word to use because a broken fuel pump and a hole in the clouds doomed Nagasaki. The B-29 boxcar spent an hour circling the city of Kokura, the mission's primary target, right, which was obscured by clouds and smoke. So with fuel dwindling, the crew flew to Nagasaki, where the cloud cover opened long enough to drop a plutonium-based Fat Man weapon with a yield equivalent to 21,000 tons of conventional explosives. Instantly, 20,000 people were killed. An estimated casualty ranges higher than 80,000. And a week later, Japan surrenders. The second date in that timeline is a day later when Earl Kim assembles a crew and decides they're going to go fly over the rubble of Nagasaki to survey the scene. And at the time, Earl Kim was an intelligence officer in the U.S. Army Air Force. He was a captain. And he had the gumption to be a witness to history, to be a witness to what he was part of. Then if you flash forward to 1981, Martha Potter Kim and Earl Kim form Musicians Against Nuclear Arms, MANA, because he felt that he had to somehow make a difference, which is inspiring. Paul and I have talked about it, Anthony Brandt. This has been a very deep subject about seeing a teacher do something. I mean, Paul's quote in the film is, anybody can write notes and music, but when you look at the man who claimed his conscience by doing this act and then founding this organization. Now, I would say if you flash forward to a year ago, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to the victims of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So when you think about his vision as someone who recognized the importance not only of nuclear weapons and war, but of peace, the possibility of driving the equation to peace, that is an extraordinary individual. And we could talk about how he stood up to McCarthyism. He returned home from, you know, one of the things Laura told me about his service in World War II, she said, you know, I heard that Earl was held at gunpoint. You should try to see if you can verify. I found three sources who told me that a gun was pushed to the back of his head, and he was told, we don't care if you're dressed in an American serviceman's uniform. We have to verify that you're not a spy. And then on top of that, Alfred Gazzetti, a professor of film, and Anthony Brandt verified to me that someone once tried to stab and kill him while he was working on this ship to repair a ship. And they make it instantly accessible because Anthony Brandt and Alfred Gazzetti, a professor at Harvard, they both told me that Leon Kirchner, who is Earl's classmate, and also somebody that helped bring him to Harvard eventually in that period of time when later he became a 23-year tenured professor at Harvard. But at the time they were both servicemen. Leon Kirchner jumped into the pile and said, "Don't kill him, he's a composer," which is just sort of, you know, funny, but sad, but true, and just tragic. And I remember last night at the screening at Harvard, people laughed, but you laugh because you want to cry. I mean, it's sort of this double-edged sword where it brings this deep emotion out that he had to live this life of being harassed and treated harshly, but he never complained about it. He never talked about it. He was very private about it. And relating it back to Beckett, Beckett served as a member of the French underground and was nearly captured by the Nazis. Some members of that group were captured and sent to concentration camps, and Beckett narrowly escaped. And when you think about the meeting that occurred in 1965 between Samuel Beckett, who later won the Nobel Prize in 1969 in literature, and you think about Earl Kim, this American composer who came to Paris with his wife Mimi to seek permission to set the writer's literary text to the composer's music, what you realize, these two different people from two different worlds, they shared this bond, and sometimes destiny aligns itself in a way that none of us can expect. All we can do is sort of admire. And I really think that his morality as a person standing up to certain things in his life were an extraordinary part of who he was and what is remembered about him. And hopefully now his music will be remembered. And so what is it that we're talking about? We're talking about a love of music. We're talking about a love of the arts. We're talking about how we recognize the arts as a sort of a fuel for humanity, for giving us a chance to express more than just the music and the art, but what do you stand for? It brings us all together. And you know, I think that the message of the film is that we need Earl Kim more than ever around us. We need Scott Hughes, we need Paul and Laura. But the point of it is that if we can just connect with each other through the arts and through music, it will define our era. It will define how civilized we are. It'll define how we treat each other, how nations are interacting. But your listeners, yeah, just find out more about this amazing person named Earl Kim, who was an American composer, but he was a composer who taught. He was not a teacher who composed. He was one of one. And because of that, it's so special for me to be here.
Ty Kim, award-winning filmmaker and director of the documentary titled Earl, period, that is. The film has been screened internationally, has won awards, and it had a special showing at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland as the centerpiece of the 10th annual conference of the Samuel Beckett Society on June 4th of this year. For more information, you should check the website, and that's earlkimcomposer.com, earlkimcomposer.com. And we're hearing this conversation on August 11th, 2025. Yesterday, the 10th of August, was the 80th anniversary of the flight composer Earl Kim took when he was in the service in World War II over the ruins of Nagasaki. The bomb had been dropped on the 9th, the day before, and we heard Ty tell us that he and his crew flew over the ruins of Nagasaki on the day after the bombing, which would have been the 10th of August or yesterday.